Wayne Collins.
One of the goals that was expressed earlier on was the move towards more principles-based accounting and, of course, principles-based auditing. And it seems to me that the increased discipline that the framework would bring to decision-making is going to be all the more needed in that kind of an environment. Are these processes being undertaken now? I think to a large degree they are, but it's certainly not something that's incorporated within every thought process. So I think it will result in better judgments. And I also wonder, would the mindset change that's going to be necessary over the next few years in the principles-based environment, to what extent there'll be a need for dramatic changes in undergraduate training, not just looking at what the rules are in a particular case, but how to apply a judgment, because that's something that you have to learn very early on in the profession.
Bob Kippers.
Thanks, Tom. Couple things. I think that as to the fundamental objective, as it now says Dell, but it said something before, the fundamental objectives would be to improve financial reporting. If this won't serve to do that, then it's probably not worth pursuing. I think there's a couple cautions, and I was just picking up on a couple comments Barbara was making. The operation of any such framework should not serve, and I don't want to be too controversial here, but companies shouldn't be able to hide from their auditors, and auditors should still be able to do the job they're hired to do. And so by following a framework, both, you know, bad faith judgments or folks trying to hide behind, saying, well, I followed all the steps, so I have to be right, you can't object to that. I think that would undermine what auditors have to do, what their responsibilities are, and what regulators have to do as well. So I think we'd have to be very cautious that that is not the end result. I do think this would tend to reduce restatements, and I think we all have experiences. The question's been asked, you know, where are the examples? Well, in the 1,600 restatements from a year ago and the 1,300 or so we've had this past year in 07, there are a number of examples where the companies actually believed they had very good support for their accounting positions, but restatements resulted nonetheless. And I think over time this would have the tendency to reduce restatements, many of which aren't serving investors very well because they almost have to be analyzed to find out whether they're problem restatements or whether they're just, you know, journal entries moving money around in the columns, which is so often the case. I guess the other thought is, not that many years ago, if a company came into the SEC and had substantial authoritative support for what they did, they tended to, you know, you'd kind of reach a draw, and the restatement wasn't always the result. I think today the tendency is that the end result is a restatement, and I would hope that a framework like this would reduce the incidences of what it might suggest are not wholly necessary restatements. And I guess the last point is on the disclosure, Ed, I know that you guys reached a judgment on that, but I would hope that there is a way that there's more transparency into the thought process that the company follows, because I think one of the challenges we have for investors is trying to let them see into the thought process one follows, to, whether it's to do an estimate or to select an accounting policy. And maybe the existing standards are okay, but I think the SEC should at least consider whether a certain amount of plus disclosure for investors might make this more beneficial.
Let me just clarify one point, and that is Bob referred to steps, suggesting or hinting that maybe this what we're proposing here is a process, and we're not. There are no steps. This is 12 buckets into which one pours judgments. It doesn't tell you how to do it. It doesn't tell you when you're done. There are no steps. So that's why I'm comfortable that this in no way limits auditors and regulators' ability to question, because it's not like you follow the framework, therefore I'm done, because that suggests that there's a process and steps to follow. There aren't. It just says there are 12 things you better think about in making a judgment frankly, I think some of those things, which I articulated in my prepared remarks, are things that are not typically done today. And if they were done, I think the quality of our judgments rise. Liz Gatnier.
From the perspective of an auditor, you know, I hear about this thing and I go, what could be the harm in this for you to give me or other auditors or my clients additional guidance on how to make good, well-reasoned, informed judgments? A couple of concerns I have would be, have you then just walked me into a documentation trap where I've made a pretty reasonable judgment, but I have failed in my documentation of what you call the 12 buckets somehow? And you somewhat, I think, answered that by saying that the framework wasn't necessarily mandatory or required, which then leads me to, so now I have to somehow explain that I use judgment in not using the judgment framework, and that one's going to be a tough sell. So I think once you put this thing out here, we have it and we've got it, and it's therefore somehow going to be what we're evaluated against. So I would just caution that what we don't end up creating is another set of problems for all of us.
Damon Silvers.
Joe had asked earlier about the views of people who serve on the Treasury Committee on Auditing. I am the chair of the Subcommittee on Audit Competition in the Auditing Industry of that committee. And I have no authority to speak for either the subcommittee or for the committee, except to say this, that the committee is, that process is a deliberative process that's underway, and it's really not appropriate for anyone to speak about it right now in terms of the substance of what's being said in that process and what people think in that process or what it's likely to result in. However, I am willing to say what I think in relationship to the process that's underway at the SEC and the advisory committee, which has presented some documents in which there's something to talk about properly. And I mean, it's a long document with a lot of, obviously a lot of thought has gone into it. Some of it, I know the chairman, Bob Posen, has been drafting things around these ideas for a long time. And I guess I have a couple of general responses. I won't take a long time responding to that document as a whole. The first is that I think there really is a need here to have understand a context. In the Treasury Committee, this enterprise, various other discussions that have gone on about auditing and accounting rules are going on in a context in which we are living through what appears to be a profound failure of judgment in relation to the subprime crisis. So there's a certain amount of urgency here, and it seems to be a profound failure of judgment among issuers and among and perhaps among auditors and credit rating agencies and so on and so on and so forth. And I think there's just an inadequate attention to context in these discussions generally. Secondly, I really don't understand what exactly these recommendations, and not just in the judgment area but in other areas, are intended actually to change. And I don't understand that in two respects. I don't understand, because I'm not an auditor and I'm not a CPA and I'm not fully conversant in all the details of the rules, I don't understand how this framework would purport to change the current standards of professional care as they exist, say, in the auditing profession or among CPAs that work for issuers. I don't understand it. Secondly, and I will read to you from your document so that we can all be talking about the same thing. The document states, the document you provided us with says that in relation to the safe harbor issue, that, of course I can't find the page now, but it says, some have proposed that a, quote, safe harbor be developed that protects the exercise of judgment in accordance with a specified framework. That approach would seem to provide greater support to auditors and preparers than a statement of policy. However, it is unclear to us whether a legal or regulatory safe harbor, i.e. an effective legal or regulatory defense based on conformity with the framework, could be adopted by the SEC or whether it required changes to existing statutes. Another approach is for the SEC and the PCAOB to issue policy statements that describe a framework for the exercise of professional judgment and state that auditors, the SEC or the PCAOB as applicable, will take into account the implementation of the framework in evaluating a judgment made by a registrant or an auditor. Now, the SEC and the PCAOB, in that sentence, you're describing their exercise of their law enforcement authority. Right? And then there's the broader issue of private litigants and private rights, both rights of issuers who feel that they've been wronged by their auditors and rights of investors. There are four legal frameworks in general that govern the behavior of auditors, which I think is sort of more relevant to this discussion in that area. They're the duties of professional care under state law, the duty not to violate the securities law, commit fraud, the requirement that the company financial statements be accurate, which is sort of drives restatements. And it's very different because it's very different than these duties around fraud and around professional care, because you can exercise due professional care and have no liability for a breach of duty of that duty. You cannot have been involved in a securities fraud. You can have been an honest and upright person entirely as the auditor. But if you still make a mistake, and it's a material mistake, it has to be corrected. If that's not true, we don't have accounting standards. Right? And then finally, there's the regulatory oversight, which the last sentence I read applies to. Regulatory oversight by the SEC, more or less enforcing the accuracy issue, and the regulatory oversight by the PCAOB, which was the subject of a great deal of your earlier remarks, in the inspection process, which is a more qualitative oversight process. I do not understand in what respect, if any, you are suggesting changing these things. And if you're not suggesting changing any of them, I don't understand what change you're actually proposing. And I think that the punchline here, right, is that this effort, which I think is well-intentioned in relation to the notion that we ought to maybe give some more guidance around what judgment is, this effort needs substantially more work. And in that regard, I think several of us in the Treasury Committee have been invited to join you all in San Francisco next month to discuss some of these issues. Unfortunately, we've been invited to do so on the date that the Treasury Committee is meeting in full session in Washington. I hope we can work that out and we can have these discussions in some greater detail.
Let me just a very quick reaction. First, Damon, certainly agree that this needs a lot more thought. And we put up a straw person framework that I don't think we suggest is God's gift to this or the final word on this. I thought we did it to try to make come alive how a framework could help make better judgments. As to your excellent legal points, I don't think we thought that through from a legal perspective. It should be thought through. So I think you're making excellent points. And, we certainly hope we can have more dialogue about this and welcome it very much.
Thanks. Let me just pause for a moment here, recognizing we still have a lot of people to hear from and we want to hear from you. I foresee us running into our break time a little bit, so please have patience with us on that point. Let me also just remind you of the other questions that we teed up for discussion. And kind of looking at the clock, my sense is we may end up having to bring these questions back to the SAG again, but in case you have some thoughts on them as we finish today's session, please provide them. But again, we may need to bring... Would that have an effect on audits, and if so, what, and what elements should be included in that framework for auditing judgments? And then suggestions on how the board could implement a framework so that it doesn't limit the ability of auditors and regulators to ask the appropriate questions. So with that, let me continue going around the table and take your comments. Randy Fletchall.
Thanks, Tom. I want to go back where Cynthia started this conversation, although, as usual, Bob Kipper's remarks preempted most of mine, so I'll try not to be too redundant. Cynthia, restatements may be coming down, but they're still at an incredibly high level, and I think everyone agrees that we run the risk of significant ones getting lost in the maze of the number of restatements. And I'll tell you, there's no preparer, no auditor who wants to be associated with one, even if they feel more commonplace these days. So I think that is an issue we need to deal with, and as Bob admitted, said we need to do that. You know, we can't sit here and get into the details of client specifics in a forum like this, but the fact that we can't doesn't mean that in that 1,000 to 1,200 to 1,500, 1,600, 1,800 restatements, how you want to count them, that there aren't more than a few instances where a preparer or an auditor's view that was well-reasoned, well thought through, good faith, preparers or others would say they don't think it was sufficiently respected or upheld. And so that's when you say, why do we need it? Yeah, things are going the right direction, but we need to move, I'd say even faster in that regard. And to Barbara's point about a move to a more principles-based system, including IFRS, I think it's not that people are looking for a free pass or to say, well, just trust my judgment and there's nothing else you can do. But if we don't have behavioral change that Ed mentioned at the outset, you know, moving to a more principles-based system in the U.S. is not going to be very successful, and that requires behavioral change from preparers, from auditors, from regulators, and I think that's what the driving force is behind this. And I couldn't agree more with the notion that while the advisory committee's recommendation right now is disclosure within the existing framework, I think that's an area that also needs further consideration in terms of a benefit to investors coming out of this process.
Vin Coleman?
Yeah, I apologize at the risk of perhaps being a little bit redundant. I do think something that's missing from this conversation just a little bit, if we could ground it, is to go back to remember that this framework, at least the way I read it, we went right to the auditors, and I think we got to start at the preparers, because I think we got to start from the way I look at this, and I want to maybe talk about what our firm has begun to do. This was around trying to drive better quality in the decision-making, knowing that this world is moving today. It was not around trying to get to a corner and then allow somebody in the system to use it as an excuse. That would be a race to the bottom. It would be, in my view, if this is applied appropriately, and I'm not suggesting this is the perfect framework, and I think a debate to make it better, particularly in the area around transparency for investors, I think would make a little bit of sense, and I think that could be debated. But when you go through this framework in an appropriate manner, it would be very difficult, more difficult than today, to have a judgment that is out of bounds. And what would help auditors and the whole system is at the time you're making a decision, similar to some of the themes that came from, and I would just ask people to think through, in December at the SEC conference, there was an acknowledgement that there can be more than one right answer with a given set of facts. And we're only going into that direction more and more as the standard setting is becoming more principles-based versus rules-based. If you have a rule, you can just simply look at it, no matter what the economics are, look at it, follow the rule blindly, and move on. We're moving away from that. We're moving then to the international standards. And when people say, is there a need for this, I would suggest to you as an auditor and a practitioner, there is a need for this. And when you go through time, the efficacy of the documentation a preparer has to look at the appropriate literature, look at the linkage to the literature, analyze what those alternatives are, and whether or not the linkage to the substance of the transaction, the underlying economics, and think through the transparency for an investor is a process of behavioral change like Randy was just talking about that could be extremely healthy and, in my view, beneficial for the whole system and the investors. I think when you talk about cost, could there be an incremental cost? I'm not so sure. I think people go through that process today. What it will do is help with the discipline when you look back of the thought process you're going through that you expect in some of the standards, Damon, you referred to, but those standards are so broad that there need to be some type of guidance and framework for each people in the system, including the regulatory authorities, that everybody's at least has the same level of expectation, and that would help.
David Becker.
Just some experience that may help people evaluate how this would work in practice. Lynn and I, when we were at the SEC, were part of an effort to introduce a certain degree of intellectual rigor into the making of the materiality judgment. In doing SAB 99, I just come to the SEC after a background as a defense lawyer, and the number of times I had heard, and I have since heard, people trying to explain what they did, including accounting matters, and say, well, you know, it's my judgment. All right, well, what does that mean? Well, it's my judgment. Okay. And the idea is to insert into that, as I say, a framework for thinking about it and for going through a process so that what's called judgment is not merely taking refuge in the ineffable, but the end result of a serious process. I think that's a good thing. I have a little skepticism as a result of the SAB 99 experience about how this will work in practice. We did SAB 99. The principal point was this is not a bright line. This requires the exercise of judgment, and your judgment should be informed by the following factors. And I think the text and subtext was, and if you do exercise your judgment this way, it will be respected. And speaking only for myself, I mean, to be sure, part of this was to stem what seemed to be a tide of very loose materiality judgments, but it was written in a way that was intended to constrain the discretion not only of preparers and auditors, but regulators as well in simply saying, nah, it's material. I don't think it has been taken quite the way I would have hoped it was taken on all sides, that instead of saying this is a matter of judgment and these are the things you have to look at, instead I think it has been taken more as a cookbook with a more complicated recipe than used to be there before. And I would worry for those who want to move to more principle-based systems, and I have some questions about what exactly that is, but I would worry that the problem is not principle-based or lack of principle-based rules, but do you have principle-based humans out there? So that no matter how you put it, it's that it's going to be taken by preparers, by auditors, and by regulators as a more complicated recipe for doing what people already do, and that perversely, this becomes something of a litigation trap, that even if you have a safe harbor that says, if you do these things, there will be no liability. And frankly, if it's the case that this produces better accounting decisions, I don't mind having a safe harbor. I might want to wait and see before I put a safe harbor into effect. But what happens is that by proceduralizing the decision-making somewhat, you then have grounds for enhanced liability. So that even if the judgment is defensible, if the documentation is crappy, you may find yourself with more complicated legal proceedings, having lawyers prepare documentation. Well, never mind. I'm in favor of it. thanks.
Jeff Mahoney.
2 points. First, on restatements, I'd just like to point out that on February 15th, Glass Lewis put out a report on the, I believe, on the 2007 restatements, found that restatements had declined among companies of all sizes. Restatements to correct accounting errors was down 15%. I believe this is the third year in a row that, at least for those companies who have implemented Section 404, that restatements have declined. In addition, it's my understanding the Treasury Department has a major study underway with a professor from Kansas on the reasons for restatements of public companies, so I would think it might be appropriate to wait for the results of that study and consider the results of that study and other information in deciding what changes should be made with respect to restatements. The other point, David read some from the report. I want to read two more sentences along the same lines on page 66. It says, quote, "It is unclear to us whether, as a matter of regulatory strategy, this judgment framework should be implemented through a safe harbor or policy statement. We leave to the SEC and its staff the resolution of these difficult issues." So the report does leave open the possibility and doesn't object to the idea that the implementation may be through a safe harbor. It's my perception, and I could be wrong, but it's my perception that most institutional investors would oppose this framework because they, I think, would believe that this safe harbor would reduce audit quality rather than enhance audit quality. I know both of you speak to a lot of investors as part of your broad range of responsibilities. I just wonder if you comment as to whether or not you believe my perception is correct. Thank you.
With regard to safe harbor, personally speaking, I'm opposed to a safe harbor. I think the language got in the report the way it is because the committee wanted to decouple the notion of a framework, which we think is a good idea, from a separate consideration about whether there's any safe harbor or how it's enacted, and separate those two pretty cleanly, because we were of the notion that a framework is a good idea regardless. I suspect that all investors, Jeff, would be opposed to anything that they believe would restrict an auditor's ability to do their job or a regulator's ability to do their job, including second-guessing judgments. So to the extent that a safe harbor, if implemented, would do that in the minds of investors, I can almost promise you what investors would say. I've convinced myself that this judgment framework is a good idea because I think in no way would it, and I'm saying without a safe harbor, in no way would this restrict. In fact, it would foster the kind of debate that I think we need to have around judgments because it points out things like you got to consider alternatives, not just one answer, your favorite. You got to think about the range of alternatives, look at the pros and cons, pick the one that reconciles best to user needs, and then reconcile what you've done to what outside third-party experts are saying. I don't think those things are done very much today. And I became convinced that that's a trade-up. And I think investors, when explained that way, would probably support it. So I think you're right about concern about safe harbor and what feelings that would conjure up in the minds of investors. But the committee, in the committee's minds, the reason we have the language here the way we do is we were trying to separate the two issues.
I'm going to go ahead and extend this session to 10:30, at which point we will take a 15-minute break. It will still be a challenge, I think, to hear from everybody, so please keep that in mind, and please do try to keep your comments as brief as possible. Lynn Turner.
Actually, I find myself agreeing with some of the things that Greg has talked about. I do think there were a lot of poor judgments at the heart of many of the failures which he mentions. And I don't think a safe harbor, I agree with him that there should not be a safe harbor. It's not going to be in the best interest of the profession, in part because of the exact reasons that David Becker pointed out earlier. We have heard input over at the Treasury Committee that from very well-known former senior officials besides David, people who have been actively involved in that role at the SEC and Corp Fin, who have clearly indicated to us that this safe harbor, rather than driving, or this business judgment rule, rather than driving down litigation, will actually turn out to be the very basis for litigation and will, in fact, drive the amount of litigation against the firms up. And certainly that's one of the factors that we're weighing at and looking there. And as Damon said, we're still going through that process. So, but it does raise some serious questions. And as I think about it and go back where you remarked, Greg, I do think you guys didn't think about that. And I think the other thing is on the safe harbor, it's clear it got teed up and got thought here. If members of the committee don't support the safe harbor, your report would be much more transparent if, in fact, you noted members don't support the safe harbor. I think that would be of great interest to investors. But going to the question that Tom Ray has teed up about the elements, I was listening to Arnie, and Arnie talked about this thing as like the Ten Commandments, and I agree with Arnie. It is very much like the Ten Commandments, and of course we know how well people follow those, which gets us back to litigation all over again. So, but when you go through and you just look at these 10 factors, you know, or 9 factors and documentation. By the way, on Enron, there was plenty of documentation. There's plenty of documentation. In fact, one audit partner had said there was so much documentation he disagreed and got pulled off the audit. So we know, you know, that's not the type of documentation hasn't always been the problem. But when I look at this, it says, first one, analyze the transaction. Well, voila, that's probably a pretty good idea that you analyze the transaction. Make sure you get all the material facts. Not a bad idea. Who can argue with that? So, you know, review the literature. Make sure you got all the literature and understand it. Well, I think you got to do that if you're going to opine on GAAP. Consider alternative views or estimates. That's basically already out there in the SAS on auditing estimates already. 5, the rationale for the choice. So you got to have a basis for what you're deciding. Sounds pretty rational to me. Linkage of the alternative estimates to the substance and the business purpose. I think that's pretty much there in the existing SAS. Diversity in practice, that gets back to the GAAP. Consistency of application, you're already required to do that under GAAP. 9, the appropriateness and reliability, that is specifically language out of the SAS. So when I look at the elements, the second question you got up there, Tom, there's nothing here that isn't already out there, common sense. And I turn around and say, does the profession really need a rule to turn around and say, go look at GAAP, go make sure you got all the facts, and make sure you analyzed them? That's all this says. And if you're going to turn around and hang yourself with litigation by going to this, I got to turn around and say, who in their right mind would turn around and do this? It is not well thought out. It doesn't add anything. As Galen mentioned, Rule 203 already gets you to some of the judgment stuff, and that can add it up with the SAS. What would help out, which, and Ed, I think you're right, I think the committee did go 3 and out and punted on disclosures. And what we've heard on our committee in public hearing is that's what investors want. And that's what they think will help fix the problem more than anything. Give us the range of those estimates. Give us the key data and assumptions that go into those. And let's get those disclosures out and then let the market discipline. When that information is out there, as the CFA Institute rep told us during his testimony, the market can get there, the analysts can get their hands around it, and they'll take it from there. But if you're telling me, and we've heard it time and time again from each of the firms today, not each of them, but from a couple of them, that they aren't doing today what they need to be, that they aren't doing those basic fundamental things in those nine items. If they aren't doing these basic fundamental things today, that should be concern for every investor, because those are nothing more than plain common sense. You don't need a rule to know you got to do this to do an audit.
Sam Ranzillo.
Well, I will try to be shorter than Lynn. I make three observations. One is, at a fairly high level, as I followed the discussions at the committee around the framework, it just struck me the fact that reasonable people thought they had to develop a framework for the use of judgment implicates to me a much broader issue with the entire system that would cause reasonable people to believe that you have to put a framework together on respecting somebody's judgment. And it's like a patient coming in with cancer and a headache and a doctor dealing with the headache and ignoring the other. So it just strikes me that this whole exercise, while I'm in support of a framework, is a broader implication of our entire system. Secondly, I would like to emphasize, at least from my own perspective, that I could not support any framework that in any way would inhibit an auditor from doing its job. And I appreciate the comments, but I will tell you the words themselves that are in the report caused me some concern as to whether or not that could end up being a very significant unintended consequence. And thirdly, I'd like to repeat, I think, very quickly around disclosures. I'm not here to debate whether this committee should have punted or not. I think that's for you to decide. But I think for this framework to ultimately have its a significant contribution to investors, the next step has to be that disclosures have got to be enhanced around these significant judgments. I think there's some frameworks that are out there that have been discussed before that never were put into place. And I think if you're going to take this thing all the way down the path of improving the judgments, and I'll grant you that maybe that will happen, then the disclosures have got to be enhanced as a product of that process.
Dick Dietrich.
First, no disclaimer, because I'm going to speak for the education community, and as you would know, I can't speak for them because they speak for themselves all the time. I have a question, but I'm going to sandwich it between two comments. The first comment is this idea of creating frameworks for judgment is something that has been well researched in an area called judgment and decision making. Let me give you a quick example. One of the games that instructors who do this in class do is to take a soda can that has been filled with pennies and then offer it for auction to students in the classroom. The highest bidder wins. The way it works out, the highest bidder is the one that's got the worst judgment. All right? And so then the instructor can go back through and talk about how to do a decomposition so that first one might think about how many pennies fits in a cubic inch, how many cubic inches are inside the can, things like that, to do decompositions. The framework here that I think is being proposed is one that adopts, as Lynn says, things that are already common sense or in the literature, but puts them in a very specific way to help people understand how to do that decomposition. And so to the extent that that's an innovation that we're not now teaching at the university level or that is not being used in practice is a very helpful thing. But that leads me to my question, and that is, why do we need to do this through any kind of action other than private action? That is it not possible for preparers to simply adopt this framework If they want to do so, they can disclose that they're adopting the framework. Their auditors can look at it and see if that's improving the decision-making process. They can use that in making their audit judgments. While I will also concede that I think to a large extent we are not doing this in the university now, I think we can if there's demand for people to be trained like this. We couldn't do it immediately, and as I have said in prior meetings, we need to be careful about things that place rigidities and inflexibilities on university education. One of them would be the CPA examination, for example. So if we wanted to have people develop this framework, give us a CPA examination that would ask the students when they're taking the exam to use these steps or parts of these steps. They could take one step, for example. You could make a question on a particular step or ask them if they can use that entire framework. If you start to build the exam that way, I can assure you that our students will come prepared to pass the exam that way. But I can also tell you it won't happen overnight. I will also remind you we now have two courses on valuation that we put in, an international financial reporting course, an ethics course, and I think I might have had one other course. So we're going to change the curriculum here very rapidly through these meetings. And so I really appreciate your suggestions. I take them back to my comments on our colleagues on a regular basis. And we really can do these things in education. So it'll take us time to get there, but we have to decide what it is we want these people to look like. And at the end of the day, those decisions will be made with your offers to students who are better prepared than those who are less well prepared. And so if you don't make those judgments, you won't see the changes.
Would the panel like to briefly respond to Dick's question?
The question, Dick, relates to why not just do this in private practice? Why do we need to put it in standards? I think there's countless places in standards where we say, think about these things. These are things you could think about. That's all we're proposing here with this framework. And we were proposing that it be put into the literature for the reason we often put into literature, you know, things to think about, because this is what we want and expect people to do. That was the only logic. It's no better than that. I agree that the more we talk about frameworks such as this, and the more we talk about ways to raise the bar on judgment, even if the SEC did nothing, it's a good thing that we talk about this stuff, because I do believe, I'm absolutely convinced, this is an area of low-hanging fruit that has not had enough intellectual discussion. Mike McCauley.
I'll just be brief. I think a judgment rule is reasonable. For many of the reasons that have been voiced by the supporters anyway. I think as the shift occurs away from GAAP and a rules-based kind of paradigm into a global standard, I think we've couched this as, you know, should we have a judgment rule? And I would go a little bit further than that. It almost sounds like it we need one. It necessitates such a framework. And I would also underscore Lynn and Sam's comments on disclosure. That's absolutely critical. If investors don't get the adequate and proper level of disclosure, I think that'll be a big loss, a big deficiency in any final framework, and will significantly reduce its effectiveness, because investors have to know and understand, and without the disclosures, they're just simply not in a position to be able to do that. So those are my comments, but I had a question. I think unless I misheard you, I think you said, well, I can't remember which one, it's made the statement that it was going to be optional, or they could choose to apply the judgment framework or not adhere to it, and that would, I think, cause investors some concern.
Howard Johnson?
Yeah, if this framework was going to be adopted, as far as auditing judgment, I've heard a lot of terms thrown out here. It's a requirement, Ten Commandments, cookbook, roadmap, things to think about. Maybe it's the best practice. Maybe this should be standard operating procedure, or is it guidance? That's going to be a big thing to determine, and then who will review it if it is adopted as a framework. Would it be part of the PCAOB inspection process down the road, or would it be just something that you look at if something bad happened about the during the audit or something to see what kind of process was used? If it's not a requirement, if it's things to think about, a best practice, or whatever, I don't see how you're going to be able to. You can't audit against mush, as I used to say. You got to have some kind of a requirement in place. And I know we have PCA, but he puts out standards. Now this is going to be a standard about a framework. That's what it would have to be, I think, if you were actually going to be able to review against it. Anything else, it really wouldn't be required. And as I read this whole document, this sounded to me like what I always said internal auditing is about. It's just applying good business judgment to the situation at hand. Maybe that's what auditing is all about. I thought it was a good document. If you're going to make this stick, you've got to make it a requirement that's subject to review.
Bob Dacey.
Thanks. I just had a couple observations on the question about PCAOB developing or adopting a framework. One of the questions was, what would this involve in terms of auditing judgments? We've talked a lot about the accounting judgments, but it seemed to be in the paper here that the proposal was this would extend more broadly to other auditing judgments. In looking at AS3, we talk about the concept that exercising professional judgment exists in nearly every aspect of planning, performing, and reporting on an audit. So it wasn't clear in terms of what the expectation was and how far this would go. But also in looking at AS3, at least we seem to identify those areas that we want auditors to document judgment, and those would be in the exercise of conclusions on relevant assertions and on significant matters, which include the selection and application of accounting principles. So just a question as to how broadly you would want to apply this to judgments. It would seem, again, to us that AS3 provides that level of what should be documented. Perhaps this somehow fits into that framework in terms of documenting enough information. AS3 allows a lot of judgment in what you document. So I'd just like to offer that up. I think in terms of the factors, we looked at those and thought about what would we use, and we couldn't come up with any more. So I think that was a good list. But we wouldn't want to limit exercise of auditor judgment. There are standards like the audit risk and materiality and the interim standards that allow the auditor to make judgments about management's judgments. And if they differ, to consider those misstatements and also to consider whether there's a possible bias. Even if management's estimates all fall within a reasonable range, you still have to stand back and say, is there a possible bias here? So we think there's things to do. The other question we would have is the result of the inspections looking at the implementation of AS3 and perhaps the standard on 312 on risk and materiality, finding any issues with where these judgments weren't adequately documented in the audit documentation. Wasn't real clear on that and whether there's anything there in terms of PCOB inspection experience that would provide some guidance into where these where this documentation needs to be improved or guidance on the documentation. And lastly, I guess kind of going on Howard's comment, we weren't really sure if this would be authoritative guidance or what it would be in terms of a PCAOB audit standard or some other guidance that we don't quite have, non-authoritative, what kind of class of guidance or standard it would exist in. Thanks.
Pat Harned.
There have been a lot of comments and great questions asked about are there principle-based people out there and what do we want people to look like, and I just thought I would offer a couple of thoughts from research that my center has done that might be useful in putting this framework into context. My center does a lot of work in trying to understand how you help people make good decisions, how you make the good judgments, and by good I mean with the highest of integrity, both for yourself and the organization you're representing, but also the clients that you're serving. And an observation I would make from what we've seen time and time again in different workplaces is that the more you provide processes and rules and very specific standards for how people should go about doing their jobs, the more you have even the most highly educated professional individuals struggling to find the courage it takes to make judgments when the rules aren't clear. And there are not many organizations out there that help people to think through the gray area situations. Why is that? It's a culture problem. It has to do with the fact that rules-based situations make it more difficult for people to actually navigate those gray areas. So one thing that is successful in those workplaces is providing a broad framework to help people to reason their way through those gray areas. And so the question I would raise as you're thinking through what should this judgment framework actually look like is how can it be leveraged to not just address the individual circumstance where you're trying to reason your way through it, but how can it also be helping to try to change the culture situation?
David, Julian?
I'd have to agree with others who said that most, if not all, of the aspects of the framework feel like common sense and reasonable practice. From a preparer's point of view, I think there's probably three groups of folks. Those are out there making sound judgments, and if they are, they're probably applying many of the aspects of this framework as they go about it. On the opposite end, I think you have those who are making not so sound judgments due to biasness, and I think any framework, they're still probably going to find a way to arrive at those judgments. And then you're in the middle where there probably are some folks who, with a more disciplined framework, might have arrived at a better judgment. And it feels like this proposal is going after that middle group. I've heard you say that it would not be required. It would be things to think about. As a preparer, my fear is that when something gets written, when something gets published in the rules, as something to think about, it becomes best practice, and very quickly, from a preparer's standpoint, it becomes a rule. And informal or formally, either the firms or others will make rules around it for a preparer to then have to follow. And I'm concerned about the burden that places on the majority of folks who are already applying these, aimed at trying to fix that middle group that perhaps could use this. And I just don't know whether the burden that it will end up applying on the preparers is worth going after helping that middle group, which I'm not convinced is the larger of the problem. Thanks.
Gary Kalperek.
Tom, thank you. I'll speak from a preparer's perspective also, and I think to try to net it out, I think as the proposal stands now, it actually is workable, and I think it's a really good first step in it. I think what it does is appropriately recognizes that judgments are a big part of what we do every day, in routine stuff and extraordinary stuff, and looking at that we have rules and guidelines and frameworks for almost everything else, you'll sort of retort that question, well, why not have a framework? And so I think we should proceed down this route. I really do think this would be useful in organizing the management thought process. When we look at it and see analyze issues, you pick it and you try to usually write up why it's the right answer to do, but this framework will more consistently bring companies to think, what are subject matter experts outside of your company in the industry saying, for example. So I think you'll think more outside of the box, you know, with the framework as it's currently written. I think that's a good thing. I think Arnie and Lynn, a bunch of others, said a lot of the stuff is already out there. It's common sense. So I think putting everything in one place is a good thing. FASB's doing a codification framework. With that in mind, it's put what's out there in one place so it's just easy to get to. Whether or not this should become codified or rule and at what level, I'd probably leave it to the board and the SEC or whoever to decide. Where does it fit in the gap or the gas hierarchy that's out there? The one concern I would have on workload is, I mean, there's judgments, you know, that are routine, ordinary course of business, well established. Then there's, I'll call it the extraordinary judgments of current issues and material, recent events, and so on. I'd like to, assuming a rule emerges, sort of get it focused, I'll call it, to the extraordinary events as opposed to routine judgments, whether it's depreciable lives or routine reserves and so on. You don't necessarily want to be documenting stuff that you know how to do and is well established. I think it's, I'll call it the disclosable events of the period, is probably what we try to narrow it down to. So. And then lastly, I think no matter how this evolves, there's nothing in here I don't think that would stop the auditors from exercising whatever audit process or audit issues they wish to raise and to challenge.
Ernie Baugh.
along with an awful lot of other people, I think most of these things that we're talking about here are just common sense. Given that, I think there's an awful lot of people that don't have a lot of common sense. Consequently, I think pointing things like this out as things that should be considered in making a judgment is probably a good thing. The other thing that I want to echo is as we move to less rules and more principles-based standards, the primary objective is to have principles-based accountants and auditors trying to follow those rules. I think that's going to be the critical thing. We've got to have principles-based people following principles-based rules.
Joe Carcello, did you want to speak again?
I do, but we've only got 3 minutes. Do you want to keep going?
Let's go ahead and use the 3 minutes, and let's get in as many of you as we can. I think we've heard from everyone at least once who wanted to speak. Am I missing? Have we overlooked someone? Okay, so go ahead, Joe, and we'll.
I'll try to cut down what I was going to say, because some of the others have said it as well. I think, you know, Greg and Ed certainly have come across as presenting this as a belief that this will improve practice. And, you know, as I read it, I didn't disagree with Arnie. I think it's actually a reasonable framework. I think where people get uptight is when you start talking about safe harbors. And I won't quote from them in the interest of time, but I have the 3 comment letters from the CEOs of 3 of the big 4 firms, and they link this framework to liability reform within 3 paragraphs of talking about the 2 different issues. And when that kind of coupling happens, investors and people who care about the public interest get nervous. So I would second what Lynn said. To the extent that there is a belief on the group that a safe harbor is not a good idea, I think if you articulate that, then I think people will be more likely to view the framework as a good faith framework.
Okay, I'm going to grant Barbara Roper the final word. Thanks.
I think that one of the things you have to keep in mind when you look at this is that this is a process, a framework that would be very easy to manipulate by the next Andrew Fasto. He could, you know, that person, whoever it is who's out there now, we can assume, could go through this entire framework, do all of the documentation, and come up with a bad application of accounting standards. And with or without a safe harbor, there is an implication that we are supposed to respect professional judgments that's built into this idea. And if that's adopted, sort of formalized, with or without a safe harbor, it will be that much harder for the auditor of that company to have the backbone to stand up against that aggressive accounting practice. And, you know, showing backbone in these situations has not been a strength of the audit profession in the past, and they have done better when they have been backed by stronger enforceable regulations. I would also say that the statement, and I'm taking it out of context, that you can't audit against mush is one of the best critiques of principles-based regulation I've ever heard. And we've talked a lot about how all of this is intended to reduce complexity. But from the point of view of investors, a set of proposals that permits and even encourages greater diversity of application of the accounting rules does not result in less complexity. It results in less comparability from company to company, from year to year, and that is not a reduction of complexity that is useful for investors.
I would just like to observe I found this discussion to be enormously helpful to me personally, and I appreciate the comments that we've heard today.
I just repeat what Greg said. I mean, we came in here, I certainly came in here with an open mind. We've got a lot of good comments and a lot of things that I think we need to reconsider, and hopefully everyone else learned something from it and had equally open mind, and we all benefited from the discussion. So thank you.
Ed and Greg, thank you very much for your presentation. We will break now and reconvene in 15 minutes.